And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. And we have Alejandro Rojas coming up with UFO updates in just a minute here. Before that, I did want to talk about our guest. He is Michael Hall. He has quite a background. He was a former Superior Court Judge Pro Tem, certified mediator, and he's also into UFOs, and we're going to be talking a lot about that. And he's out on the West Coast in near the Seattle area, Washington State, anyway. So I wanted to just say something really quickly here, because a lot of times, I get, there's a lot of negative feedback on YouTube, and that's just the way it is. I understand that. And a lot of times I don't read any of the messages. So that's why sometimes I never respond. But sometimes I do read them, and I see some really good points that someone makes, and sometimes really good critiques. So I take it all. And I got this really nice message, and I've always been, a little bit concerned about my professional life when it comes to UFOs and how they may cross. So I got this mail. I'm just going to read it to you because I thought it was really nice and I really liked getting it. I'm a longtime listener to the Antiques Forum. That's my show. I do a podcast on antiques called the Antiques Auction Forum. And he writes here that he found my UFO show. And boy, was I surprised and skeptical. But I thought I'd listen to a couple of episodes, as I hold you in high regard and believe you to be a straight-up guy. Anyway, the second episode I listened to was about the Nimitz case. And boy, I soon learned why you have an interest in this area. My views have changed quite a bit with such credible witnesses. So since then, I've listened to a few, and I've done my own Googling on the Nimitz case in particular. I really like the way you bring your logical antiques brain to the program and seek to find the truth and call out the fakes. That is healthy, as I, like many people, tend to lump everything together. Incidentally, I'm into boating, so we share a couple of interests, and now you can add UFOs to that. Anyway, he says a lot of really kind things. I just thought I'd add that to the show, because I thought it was a very nice thing for someone to write, and also it's probably the first vindication that I really had that people are okay with me doing UFOs and antiques at the same time. Alejandro, so nice letter, isn't it? That was a nice note to get.
It's a great letter, and it's funny because you say it was vindication that people are okay with you. That's what's funny. He wasn't at first. He was thinking, yeah, oh, great, Martin, I like this guy, and turns out he's a UFO weirdo. But luckily, yeah, he liked you enough to listen to the show and saw there was credible stuff. So that's really cool. It's a great story.
Oh, by the way, he said I could say his name. He's Tony, and he's from Sydney, Australia.
Ah,
so
from
thank
Australia.
You, yes. Yeah. I have a lot of listeners, by the way. I'm sure you do, too. In Australia, a country of, what, 26 million people? It's like second.
A lot of people down there.
Yeah, like second or third as far as listeners to the show, which is great.
I would love to go out there, too, and
so
visit sometime. Ben Hansen, our good buddy, goes out there and does talks out there once a year.
It's a long
tour. That'd be fun.
Takes forever to get there, but I really want to go there in the winter.
Winter
here, summer there.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah. So what's going on in the UFO world? Quite a bit, again.
A lot, as usual. Of course, the biggest story is this thing about storming Area 51.
Oh, yes.
So I wrote a story this weekend, and this isn't just to plug my story. Of course, it is largely about that, but also to talk about the details in the story. What I wrote was the people who have gone past the warning signs at Area 51. And I put this on my blog at alejandrotrojas.com, but I actually wrote it for the Roswell Daily Record, so some form of it will go up there. But my point is, as I was writing the story this weekend, the clicker was at about 690,000. By the time I finished my story, it was out up to about 710. Now it is at, if I saw right, 1.4 million. So it's doubled since just a couple days ago when I wrote my story. So this thing is really going up and up. And I actually contacted the Lincoln County Sheriff's Department. And here's why. If you read my story is about three different people who went across the line and what happened to them. And essentially what happens is the guards hold you until the police come because it's their jurisdiction. But you could be waiting there with your face in the dirt for a long time before, and you'll be manhandled and shoved in the dirt, you know, until the police get there. The police had no comment. They said, "We're aware of this, but we have no comment." However, the Air Force has told Washington Post, you know, "We're ready for it. You don't do it, and we're going to be ready if you try it." So, yeah, it's amazing that this is getting news all over the place. The question is, are people going to show up? Sure, it started as a hoax, apparently. In fact, if I look at the description for the event, all it says is, "We will all meet up at the Area 51 Alien Center tourist attraction and coordinate our entry. If we Naruto run, we can move faster than their bullets. Let's see them alive." And Naruto's a cartoon, if for those of you who don't know, these kids training to be ninjas, so they run very fast and they dodge bullets. So even though this seemed to be a joke to begin with, you know, with 1.4 million, I think people are going to show up. And what's scary is people like George Knapp or Nick Pope, I've retweeted their tweets saying, "Hey, this is a really dumb idea." George Knapp's was funny. "Hey, if you do it, it's going to make for a good story that I'll write, you know, because he's there in Las Vegas. But don't do it because it's dumb." And I was surprised at the number of negative responses they got, where people are like, "Oh, you're just being negative. You just don't want us to find the truth.
Disinformation, so, you know, agent."
Yeah, exactly. So there's a host of people out there who I think are taking this seriously. So I hope that the authorities are ready, and we'll see what happens. I think it is a bad idea. And I'm really highly considering going just to cover what may or may not happen.
When I was on your show, yes, we talked on your show about this as well. And we were talking about the possibility of Facebook shutting that down, which I hope they do. But I was just thinking about this today. If Facebook did shut it down today, I bet something would still happen. You know what I mean? Because there's so many people involved.
It would still be a news story. And, of course, we were talking about shutting it down because essentially it's illegal. You can't storm Area 51. That's illegal. And so this post is advocating and essentially a real conspiracy to commit a crime with 1.4 million people at Area 51. So that's why we were speculating maybe they'll shut it down. They haven't yet, and I don't know that they will. Of course, they have a lot of time to do it. This event isn't planned until September 20th. So it'll be really interesting. I wonder how many of your listeners have clicked the going button. I clicked the interested button because I'm interested to see what happened. There's about 1.1 interested people, a million interested people, 1.4 million say they're going. So, yeah, that's a big news story that's all over the place. But I'm really proud of my story because I've written this about these other people who have gone across, and some of it's pretty fun. And a couple of these stories that I posted have videos, so you can actually see what happens.
Yeah,
if you check that out. But yeah, that's a big story out there.
So what happens when you click on it that you're interested? Are you getting any like notices or something like that through Facebook?
You know what? I haven't noticed that I've been getting any notices at all, to be honest. I thought maybe I would, but I'm not sure what kind of notices I would get. But I haven't been getting anything that I've noticed at all. Of course, I'm overwhelmed with notifications on and comments on so much other things going on right. Facebook that I could have missed it. But yeah, so far I haven't seen anything.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Well, this will be really interesting how it plays out. And I just hope no one gets hurt, you know, and no one really wants to spend time in the dirt.
Yeah, exactly. No one wants to spend time in the dirt. And it was funny because I told these stories, of course, when I was going with the Kardashians, Area 51, I got to take them. I told these stories to them on the way up to make sure they understood, do not cross those lines.
Yeah.
And if you watch the show, they were really freaking out. They were telling their dad, at the time, Bruce, now Caitlin, don't cross, don't cross. And he kind of tried to scare him. But, yeah, I would not want to experience that. But you were telling me about a listener. We were talking before we came on who was mentioning a Popular Mechanics story. And besides this Area 51 story, we've had a lot of very positive media talk about UFOs. And this Popular Mechanic one is a good one. It's the same. And I like it because I'm a fan of Popular Mechanics, but they've always been very negative. In fact, when I was back with MUFON, they wrote this really bad one. It was during the Stephen Bill years. It was terrible. Hmm. But this article is pretty good. It's I don't know. It says five scientific reasons for believing in aliens. And I'm going to go over the five reasons real quick here. SETI Institute. I don't think this is a scientific reason for believing in aliens. It just means that these scientists believe in aliens. Yeah, and they're searching for aliens. So maybe, I guess, because these scientists do, that you should too. Number two is UFOs pique the Pentagon's interest. That doesn't mean you should believe in aliens, or nor does it give, nor have they said they have scientific evidence of aliens, but it's still a great story, so I'm glad that they include it. Three, the Navy jet UFO encounters. Those, of course, are interesting. We've had witnesses on scientifically, you know, so they're interesting. Four is Oumuamua, which I don't think is alien at all. It's probably, you know, just kind of some natural thing here. But that scientist we're talking about aliens around it is interesting. And then five, a plethora of exoplanets. And I think this is the best scientific case, just to show that there are way, way, way more planets out there than even the scientists expected. And of course, if our lonely little planet here that we know so well has life on it, then what are the chances that the numerous, the millions and millions of other planets out there may have intelligent life as well? The odds are probably pretty good. So it is a great Popular Mechanics piece there. But otherwise, lots of other UFO news going on. If you want to know more about that, the headlines out there, of course, go to the front page of openminds.tv and you'll see them there in the headlines.
Wow. Hey, I just looked in chat. We have Kevin Day in chat and Chris Lambright. Wow, it's an all-star chat this evening.
Awesome.
How about that, huh?
Kevin's awesome. I can't wait to meet him at the UFO Congress. He's going to be speaking at the Congress.
That's right. That's right. Hey, Alejandro, thank you so much. And
yep, thank you.
And we'll talk to you next week. Have a good one.
All right. Talk to you next week.
And don't storm Area 51.
Yeah. Don't plan on it, but I'll take pictures of the people who do.
Yeah. All right. Take care.
Maybe some video.
Yeah. All right. So our guest this evening is Michael Hall, and he is a former Superior Court Judge Pro Tem Certified Mediator, founding partner of the Hall Law Firm. Anyway, I'm going to skip all the way down to this part where he has a lifelong interest in UFOs, and we'll be talking about that and so much more. He's also part of the UFO I-Team. He just got back from some four-day excursion. We're going to talk about that. And so, Michael, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Hey, Martin, I'm doing really well.
Good,
let
good.
Me turn my
need your camera
thing on here so I can see you.
Yeah, there you
how
go.
How are you?
All right, great. Thanks a lot. Welcome to the show.
And I'm really excited to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Yes, you're very welcome. And we're going to be talking about all kinds of things. For the person who is unaware of who you are, can you go ahead and give them the thumbnail description of what you do, how you got into this this crazy subject of UFOs? Not so crazy anymore, though.
Yeah, isn't that something? Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you know, like most of us out there, I've been interested in UFOs my entire life, ever since I was a little kid. I think my professional career basically started back in 1974 or so when I was a field investigator for the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, Coral and Jim Lorenzen's group back in those days. Also, over the years after I became attorney, I became representing a lot of ufologists, basically. Some of their setting up their programs for their corporate entities, and every once in a while there's some legal issues that come along. For instance, when Peter Davenport purchased his underground missile site in Eastern Washington.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I was the guy who put that deal together for him. I've been Peter's attorney for the last 25 years and the National UFO Reporting Center. Also, Dr. Richard Haynes, the pilot reporting agency, NARCAP, I've been their attorney since 99. I go back all the way to Dr. James Harder, representing him back in the old days. And
I've heard the name. I don't know much about him, but I have definitely heard the name.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was the lead scientist for APRO back in the 70s. Mm. He was the first guy to get a hold of Travis Walton, actually, and do an actual investigation and hypnosis regression with Travis initially after his 1975 sighting. So, it goes back a long way. Of course, I represent Grant Cameron with all these new breaking things that have been going on, you know, on the Wilson memo and the Santilli, alien autopsy films and all that stuff. So I've been involved a long time. And, basically, I'm way beyond the point of do aliens or UFOs exist. We're trying to get down to the bottom line of what's behind the issues and what's behind the big push for disclosure right now, as we know in the mainstream media.
You know, I've had a lot of people argue that point, and they're saying there's been a soft disclosure for a long time. And so what are your comeback from that statement?
Well, Grant Cameron would say that, you know, ever since he got into this thing about 40 years ago, that there are these programs of soft disclosure. They push something out, they pull it back, and then they push it out again. And matter of fact, a lot of the main players kind of morph from one organization to the other. You know, there was the Avery back in the old days. Then, you know, of course, the NIDS, you know, organization came along with Robert Bigelow, and now the Two of the Stars Academy. It seems to be some of the same people involved throughout this whole disclosure process. But I tell you what, ever since that New York Times article, December 16th, 2017 came out, for some reason, there was a massive agenda right now to red pill the public on the issue of UFOs. And eventually it's going to have to be the issue of aliens as well. So that's the fascinating thing. And I have, in my long career of over 40 years, studying this stuff pretty heavily, I've never seen this push at this point on mainstream media, on, you know, the History Channel, all sorts of television series and movies coming out to actually get people up to speed on these strange paranormal issues that we're all going to have to deal with if there's a huge paradigm shift happening and coming towards us.
You know, one of the things, you mentioned aliens a couple of times there, and the one thing that I've seen, you know, say, for instance, Lou Elizondo make perfectly clear is that he doesn't want to use the word aliens. It's just an unknown. And are you actually thinking that? I mean, I like to hear other people's opinions, but you have your thought is that you think that it is actually aliens that we're seeing, driving these crafts, or there's all kinds of theories.
Oh, yeah.
You do?
Oh, yeah. No, you know, if we've got our Top Gun pilots out there, Luis Elizondo, Chris Mellon, everybody in ATIP, basically saying, well, we really don't know what these are, but we can't do what they do. There's no chance out there that the Soviets or the Chinese or some advanced civilization on our own planet is creating these craft that can do these things. So, you know, I'm going towards the Wernher von Braun, you know, prediction of the enemies out there that will be, you know, gracing our borders here. Of course, first was the Russians. You know, that was something that we needed to have during the Cold War and before. And then, of course, it was the terrorists were the next issue that Wernher von Braun brought up. Then, of course, there was rogue nations, just, you know, various nations out there, like, you know, North Korea, whatever. And the last one, most notably, was the asteroids. That was kind of fun. I remember when they were pushing those a few years back. Then, of course, the last false flag or, you know, enemy that we're going to have to fight is the aliens. So even though they're not talking about that, you know, on ATIP and on Unidentified on the History Channel yet, they sure did give you the impression that there's some threat out there. And I think that's what they're going to be heading towards next is the evil alien agenda, which we need to be very discerning about.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of skepticism when it comes to what it is and theories. And, you know, I had a professor on here, I don't know, maybe 3 weeks ago that had a theory that it's actually us from the distant future. You know, coming back, he had quite a background, too, where he made quite a good case. I'm not saying that I believed him any more than anything else, but he actually made a really great case for time travel as what we're seeing. You know, and I think the reason, you know, I'm sure you know the reason, the number one reason this comes up and different theories come up is because of the vast distances, that, you know, an alien would have to travel to get here. And of course, they may figure out something in physics that we haven't thought of yet to get here. You know, that's very possible. But it's all fascinating. But, you know, the way this, the one thing I always wonder about, if it is aliens and they are traveling here, if they want to go back to where they're from, how can they escape this time difference? In other words, you know, when they come back, everyone they knew is gone. And, you know, I mean, maybe they figured a way around that, too. I mean, have you ever thought about that type of thing?
Well, yes, I have. As a matter of fact, you know, this is real timely, given the fact that there's some interesting details listed in the 15-page Admiral Wilson Core Secrets document that has just been released. There's a spot in that document where they are claiming, basically, at least Commander or Admiral Wilson is telling Eric Davis, Dr. Eric Davis, who's interviewing him in this memo. He's telling him that he was told they have an actual working craft, a extraterrestrial craft that can travel through interstellar space, through our atmosphere, of course, underwater, he mentions in this memo, and through dimensions. This is a working craft that basically is being talked about by high government level J2, Joint Chiefs of Staff, you know, in charge of all the intelligence companies or, you know, divisions of all the military, are talking about he is running across this information that these kinds of things transcend dimensions, let alone time. There's also a letter in this 15-page memo by Commander Will Miller, it's being sent to Dr. Davis, who claims that there is a scientist that is working on time travel, and he's got what they call the force theory of the universe. And so I think time travel is very, well, it's something that they've talked about and probably someone has conquered already. I don't know about us coming back from the future, you know, and being UFOs and trying to warn us of something or whatever like that. It's very interesting. You would think that if you're messing around with the past, if you go back into the time and want to mess around with the past or tweak the past, obviously there's multiple butterfly effects that could happen for your own future when you go back as well. So,
you know, I brought that up during, we have to go to break here in just a couple minutes, but I brought that up to this gentleman, this professor, and he had an answer for that too. I think he basically said that no, once something has happened, it's happened in where you are in the world you're in or whatever, and you can't change that, which I don't know. If one thing I didn't think to ask him is if that was the case, then why would they bother coming back and saying be good to your world, you know, don't pollute and whatever it is you're saying, don't destroy the planet if nothing changes in their world, you know what I mean?
Good point.
Yeah. all these paradoxes, you know. It's
exactly.
It's really fascinating. And so isn't what you mentioned about these the government officials and this craft that they're, you know, I think it's the Navy patent. But these are all theories at this point. Isn't that right?
Well, if you read the 15 pages of that Wilson memo, which I encourage everyone to do, you know, you can go to Twitter and download it. You can load it anywhere if you just Google the term Admiral Wilson UFO memo or Core Secrets memo. Everyone should read it. It's very detailed. And the documents or the things that they're talking about in that specific part about a working craft is not a theory. He's talking about that they have a theory that these things could work. Admiral Wilson is telling Dr. Eric Davis that his understanding is that they have a working craft that can do these things. So there's a whole lot of interesting things in that memo that most people don't really have the opportunity to get into the details of it because it is 15 pages long. It's mostly single-spaced, and it names dates and times and programs that are being run, unaccountably run, by the way. No government or military oversight by civilian subcontractors that work for the government. So I would encourage everyone to get into the details of that.
Okay. And when we come back from this break, I do want to point out a couple of arguments for that also. But let's go into break right now. This is Martin Willis, and my guest tonight is Michael Hall, and we'll be right back right after these messages.
Clear. 3 minutes, gentlemen.
3 minutes. Okay, thank you. So we're still live. We're still live on YouTube. And so I just going to start the timer right here. So I know we'll probably get back into this, you know, when you and I are going back on the regular show, but I did want to ask you about the amount of sightings out in Washington. Now, I know, of course, you know, 1947, they're very famous starting out out there. It's a Mount Rainier, I believe.
Yeah, and actually we had even one before then that was the modern day UFO thing. 2 weeks before Mount Rainier, there was Maury Island.
And I can tell you
a little bit about that too.
That's been pretty much proven a hoax, I believe.
No, it wasn't. It was actually proven that the guy said it was a hoax to get everybody off his back, but there was so many people involved with that thing that the issue, matter of fact, I know the two guys that put together the Maury Island incident film, one of them is an attorney friend of mine, Steve Edmondson and Scott Schaefer, really good researchers and stuff, and they come up with the whole scenario of how that thing happened, and this guy's life was just ripped to shreds by the first Men in Black, by the way, that showed up, you know, and threatened him and his family. And his son actually disappeared for 2 weeks, kidnapped his son, his 14-year-old kid. So you can imagine why he was pretty much done with the thing after the initial sighting. He said whatever they want him to say.
Well, I will. I'm going to have you school me a little bit more on that. We'll communicate through email, but I'd like to know more of why you think that's, you know, that really happened. It's so confusing, isn't it, to know sometimes when I think a case is really solid, then I find out, oops, you know, so it's really hard.
Well, that's the whole thing with the Santilli alien autopsy film coming back and, you know, coming to the fro right now. This is just nuts. You know, some of those things have been recycled and recycled, and we get more and more, or maybe less and less information. You never know every time they come out.
Isn't this just, we only have a few seconds here left, but isn't this just a way for Santilli to make a little more money? I mean, this is what I would think right off the bat.
Well, I would think so, but I have another theory on that about, you know, there were people that saw a very similar alien autopsy film earlier than 1995 when he created his. I think the Santilli film was maybe a disinformation, kind of like a Bob Emmenager problem where they would show something being a hoax just to kind of, you know, muddy the waters on people who actually saw some real footage earlier than 1995. So that's a fascinating story that we're involved with, Grant Cameron and myself right
now. 20 seconds, gentlemen.
Okay, 20 seconds. That's good. Thank you. So we'll go back and we'll jump right back to where we were on this Wilson UFO document here when Bill brings us back on.
Great.
Ready here, Bill, whenever you are.
All right, I'll count you back in a sec.
All right.
Stand by in 3, 2, 1, go.
All right, welcome back. My guest is Michael Hall. And right before the break, we were talking about the Wilson UFO memo, the leaked, they call it the leaked memo and all that. And I said I was going to argue, not, I don't mean really argue, but, you know, discuss some of the things that I've heard about this in particular. One of them is I know that Wilson himself was called and he denied it, you know, and I know, of course, you know, that that's a possibility of someone denying something, even if it's real or not. So I don't know how much, you know, credence that gives. But also there's some question on the letterhead. What can you say about the letterhead was not correct? What do you think? What's your thoughts about that?
Yeah, well, the letterhead that you're referring to is the Commander Willard Miller wrote a letter to Dr. Eric Davis and kind of inquired as to whether they would want to have some contacts that they were looking for in about alien retrieved alien and back engineered alien hardware. And so in that letter, he uses a kind of like a letterhead that looks to be like some kind of an eagle with, you know, a banner around it or something. The basic explanation of why people don't recognize that is because supposedly Commander Miller was retired at the time and was just basically using a personal letterhead that he put together, you know, to send out letters. Other people, including Dr. Stephen Greer, by the way, who was at this initial briefing of Admiral Wilson in 1997, along with Edgar Mitchell and Willard Miller. Stephen Greer says that that's a letterhead he recognizes himself from the retired Willard Miller. So that's kind of been, you know, put to bed in that regard. It's not an actual government agency that's on that letterhead.
And what about Davis's his reaction to this whole document?
Well, you know, it's very, very interesting because when you're talking about the definition of a core secret, and you put that in quotes when you're talking about something that is a military program or any kind of a thing that the military is working on, when they designate it a core secret, even the denial or the no comment regarding that subject can be a security breach. So basically the idea that if it's a core secret, you can't even really acknowledge it. So what happened with Eric Davis and Hal Puthoff, by the way, both of them responded to inquiries about whether this memo and the Willard Miller letter were true and correct. They both went on at length, basically, that said no comment. But they didn't say just no comment. They said, you know, because of our security clearances that we, some of us still have, and they're talking about Hal Puthoff and Dr. Eric Davis and some of the other people that are involved in the NIDS organization currently, because of their current, you know, classifications and clearances that they have, they can't even comment on this thing. So they couldn't come out and say vociferously they're denying that this is a fake. But they had to explain that in quite a few words, that they were just basically giving no comment.
So you're saying that they actually denied that this thing is a fake in a roundabout way? Is that what you're...
Well, some people are claiming that the fact that they didn't come out vociferously denying that this was a hoax, you know, gives some kind of a credence to these things being potentially true and correct. But in reality, if you're actually looking at a classified, unacknowledged special access program that's a core secret, you can't even deny or you know, get into the details of something being false and not representing a real program. So but they're craftily denying it in more than a few words, which kind of throws a red flag up for some folks.
I see. Now, I heard that an Australian UFO researcher had this document for, say, 10 years or something like that prior?
I wouldn't say it was that long, no. Matter of fact, Edgar Mitchell passed away, what is it, 90, four, I believe.
Edgar Mitchell? No, that was just a couple years ago.
So it was basically the theory is that these documents came from Dr. Edgar Mitchell's estate. Basically, I understand that his heirs, his family didn't really care about some of these issues that he had, you know, put together in banker boxes worth of material. So one of the individuals that knew Edgar Mitchell got to hold of these boxes of documents. And then the gentleman that you're talking about from Australia, by the name of James Rigney, actually got a hold of one of these boxes of documents, was able to go through it, found the 15-page memo, and knew that this was quite important. So basically in November of 2018, just last year, he actually gave it to Grant Cameron. And Grant Cameron, when he found it, or when he saw it, basically told me that he went, his face went ashen. He couldn't believe, even on the first page of this document, noting the names and the details that are mentioned on there, Grant said that this was the most important document he has ever seen in ufology. And of course, Richard Dolan has called it the smoking gun UFO memo of the century. So that's how important this document was. So since 2018, and then Grant got a hold of me in 2019 because he needed to figure out what are we going to do with this document? What does he have as far as liability to, release this kind of a document to the public? And eventually what we did in 2000, January or so, we actually formed a disclosure trust that I've created for whistleblowers specifically to put documents and artifacts and various things into a state planning entity that they can control the access and the dissemination of, just in case something happened to Grant in the interim. Then, of course, what happened in June 7th on Twitter was the thing got actually released, not by Grant Cameron or myself, but actually an anonymous source released the document. Now everybody knows about it and has gone through it with a fine-tooth comb.
All right. When you say it was released anonymously, was it by a tweet? Is this how this thing was released and then linked? Can't someone search this out and figure out who it is that released it?
Yeah, good point. Because you would think that, the really hotshot computer hackers out there could trace this down and figure out where it came from. So far, no one's been able to do that. Basically, it came from a site called Imgur, I-M-G-U-R. It was posted there initially, and honestly was posted on Reddit prior to that. Months back, I understand, it was on Reddit. Mm-hmm. And it was ignored, I understood.
Yeah.
But June 6th, actually, it was actually posted again on Twitter, which, basically hit the mainstream big time.
Okay, well, there's a lot of people that are saying that this is just a fake document. There's nothing to it. There's people saying that even if it's real, it's not that big of a deal. What's your thoughts about those comments?
Well, my comment would be that if this was a major disinformation program, basically if the government, for instance, was looking to muddy the waters with some kind of a document that would eventually be proven to be false, if I was in charge of that kind of a disinformation program, I sure would not come up with a 15-page transcript or memo, whatever you want to call it, with all the names of people who are living, by the way. Some of them passed away, but a lot of them are still living, and programs that could be cross-checked and make sure that they were still alive, available and working, and dates and times. I would not do that in such detail. If I was going to make a disinformation campaign, it might be, a couple, three pages long, and I'd pick maybe two or three names that I could definitely control, whether they would come out and say, it's a hoax or whatever. But I'll tell you what, there are so many Pentagon and, government officials that are named in this document that can be searched out and determine if they're actually in the positions that they're talked about being in during this memo. There's also many other organizations like the people at NIDS, Dr. Stephen Greer and Edgar Mitchell. There are remote viewers that are named. There's even another attorney that's named in this document, this 15-page memo, that has represented one of the remote viewers in the past. And boy, I tell you what, I have gotten many phone calls and emails into that gentleman. I'd like to be able to talk with him personally myself, just to see what he would know about the details that are in this memo itself. Even Willard Miller, Commander Willard Miller, who has now come out and said that, you know, this document, his at least his letter part of the document, looks to be a cut and paste, of something that he might have written or not written. I basically have confirmed through some of the other researchers out there that he actually remembers that he wrote some of that. And specifically, he's talking about the initial paragraph of his letter where he's inviting Hal Puthoff and Dr. Davis to a scientific meeting in Tallahassee, Florida, to meet another scientist working on this time travel, you know, and dimensional, you know, issues and stuff. So he remembers writing that. He remembers, and actually the date and the time and the address on the letter is his home address. That's been confirmed as well. But some of the other things in the memo where they're saying that, you know, if you want to get a hold of some of these people that are involved in the reverse engineering programs that the government has, Willard Miller is saying that he can hook up, you know, Davis and Puthoff to those folks, as well as a bunch of other programs out there there was sightings on the East Coast of the United States that he was talking about. He could hook up with some flag rank officers that would know all about that. So it seems to me that there are some very, if I ever had an opportunity to cross-examine a witness that was supposedly written a letter like Commander Willard Miller did, I would ask him, what parts of this letter do you remember? You know, and then find out, well, what parts are there's something you don't remember, and why don't you remember those things? So very fascinating detail in this document.
And when was the date of that document?
This document was created in October 16th of 2002, when Dr. Eric Davis was able to get a meeting with Vice Admiral Thomas Ray Wilson. They met in the Admiral's staff car, the backseat of the staff car behind the EG&G building in Las Vegas, Nevada on that day. And Eric Davis basically, as far as I can see, had some kind of a recording device recording all the details of their conversation for an hour and 10 minutes. That's the only explanation I can see of how detailed this memo is. I wouldn't think that someone from their own memory could reconstruct the actual dialogue that he does in this memo. And basically, it is the recollections of Admiral Wilson being shut down in 1997 from access to a reverse engineering program by a government civilian contractor who would not allow him to have access as J2, Joint Chiefs of Staff, Second in Command, who's in charge of all the subcontractors and all the military intelligence departments. They said he did not have a need to know what their program was about. Eventually, they told him and confirmed that they were a reverse engineering program of alien technology that was not of this world. Fascinating stuff.
Wow. And this, you know, a lot of this sort of rings of the MJ-12 documents, you know, I mean, it's very similar in a lot of different ways. And, you know, it's going to be awful hard to convince, convince everyone in the UFO community that this thing is 100% right. Or even if it's, you know, partially right, that would kind of throw up a lot of red flags he's saying he remembers part of it. Well, that's interesting, but it would really, you know, like you said, if you could bring this person into court and you know, have them testify about it, you know, maybe you'd get some more information. Have you actually yourself tried to get more information on this document by making contacts?
Oh, yes, for sure. And not just myself, but there's, you know, a lot of the young guns out there as well. You know, Frank Stalter and Chan Hanna and all those folks that are out there doing their best to dig deep and find out the veracity or the falsity of this document. There's a very interesting thing that is mentioned on the last page of this 15-page memo, by the way, that you brought up a very interesting point, that indeed there could be some disinformation in this document itself, because there's a gentleman by the name of Jacques Gansler, who is a friend of Admiral Wilson, who meets him at the Pentagon after this whole fiasco happens, and Admiral Wilson is asked to stand down and not pursue this anymore, or else he's going to lose a couple stars and be retired early. Hmm. Jacques Gansler himself, a Pentagon official at the DOD, told Admiral Wilson that, you know, yeah, UFOs exist. They're talking informally, but alien abductions don't exist. That is an interesting twist at the end of the document that really throws a kink into things for the UFO community, and you wonder what that information was in there for.
Wow, that is interesting. We have about 9 minutes to go to the last break we have in the show. And so for the person lazy like myself out there that I just skimmed through it a little bit, can you give some of the highlights and why you think it's really important?
Yeah, for sure. By the way, Martin, I realize that it is a lot to take in, because I've had this document under my perusal for over 6 months and have gone through all the dates and details and organizations to, you know, vet them. So what I'm going to do is I'm writing what I call an executive summary of this entire memo that will be available for people to really just kind of get a flow of the thing. So that should be a little easier for folks to handle. That will be up on the UFOI team Facebook page very shortly, and on YouTube as well. I'll get you a copy for sure. But there are so many things in this document that seem to ring true, including the basic idea that MJ-12 existed. They are talking about the fact that Admiral Wilson got confirmation from various people in the Pentagon and these subcontractors that a group that was either called MJ-12 or the Cabal or anything like that, that was in charge of alien craft actually existed. So that was something that the admiral is saying that he found out in this thing. Matter of fact, when he called these subcontractors to finally confront them with what they knew and why he didn't get briefed about the situation, they actually started spilling the beans a little bit about what was going on, and they could only go so far. And then they said, it's a core secret, Admiral. We can't tell you.
Interesting. So, and what are some other things that came up in, say, the conversations with Eric Davis and that part of it that were, you know, that the listener interested in UFOs would like to hear?
Well, you know, there's all sorts of details in that document about the idea that there were a crash at Roswell, New Mexico. Not only that MJ-12 existed, but the crash at Roswell, New Mexico happened. The retrieved technology is being studied by these reverse engineering programs that are run by civilian contractors. There's the whole idea that there was something called a bigot list of need-to-know people that each of these organizations keep. And unless you're on their bigot list, which is B-I-G-O-T, and it sounds very racist, but it's basically an anachronism backwards that stands for To Gibraltar, which was a code name used during the World War II invasion at Normandy to start planning that event. And they ended up using the reverse of that instead of To Gibraltar, bigot backwards as a code name of anybody who has a need to know for a specific unacknowledged special access program. So when the admiral met with this civilian contractor, they showed him their bigot list, and he was not on it. There were no U.S. presidents, no White House personnel, no congressional personnel, no military personnel on this list. Only a few Pentagon employee officials that oversee the program. So those are very fascinating conversations that Eric Davis was having with Admiral Wilson about the details of these programs. And basically, this was one program dealing with one reverse engineering aspect of the whole phenomena. So you never know how many others are out there.
Interesting. Well, you know how long ago Roswell was. And if they brought forward some type of craft gear and they were reverse engineering it, that's a long time. That's, what is that, 70, you know, years?
72. Now,
and how could they possibly keep that, you know, quiet? First of all, how could they keep that quiet? And if it's in, I'm talking specifically, if it is in the hands of a private, which I actually would agree that is a great way to, you know, to hide, you know, keep out of Congress and, you know, anything else, is to get it in the private sector. But how could this be grandfathered from, it's generational at this point. So how could something like this make it through generations of, say, reverse engineering, or, you know, a company, you know, working on trying to discover what these things are and how they work? We have about 4 minutes left.
Okay, well, you know, that's the whole Bob Lazar story right there in a nutshell, which is kind of strange. Bob Lazar comes out with, or they come out with a movie about Bob Lazar just very recently, and this memo comes out shortly thereafter, basically confirming the idea that these civilian back engineering or whatever programs that we've got working for the military are really hamstrung themselves. In the memo, it's mentioning the fact that they have very slow progress in reverse engineering these special projects, and they are stuck using basically the personnel that are only on their bigot lists. They can't access the wide range of scientific consultants out there in the world that could help them, and they can only use their own facilities due to the stove piping and the, you know, the secret things that they have to keep, you know, depending on their budgets too. So it kind of goes on for decades from what this memo is saying, with very slow progress, which is kind of a flies in the fact of there could be also a, you know, a reverse or a secret space program that's already doing all this stuff. So we almost have like two things going on at the same time, you know, and you never know which ones are the correct versions of reality out there.
We're going to be taking calls in hour two, but I just happened to notice, and I can't really pay attention to chat too much, but I noticed a question from a Jay Allen. He wanted to know which remote viewer is mentioned in the memo.
It was two women. And I don't have the memo off the top of my head, but I'll tell you who it was. It was the woman who actually channeled an alien at the, I think it was Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And she was meeting with some of the high brass there that she had convinced that she could do this. And in reality, what she did is she actually made an arrangement for one of the actual officers that were there to become a channeler himself. And an alien craft showed up outside their window at Wright-Patterson to do that. I forget her name off the top of my head, but she's one of them. Very famous incident that's been written about in ufology over the years.
Oh, okay. All right. So a lot of people know, my longtime listeners know, that I'm sort of skeptical about certain things. And so a lot of things we're talking about tonight, I'm sort of skeptical about. I'm letting you talk. You're making a good case for things. But I will have to tell you that Bob Lazar is on my skeptical list. And a lot of people are not happy about that. But I personally think that Jeremy did a good job with the movie he did, but I still think that I was trying to be convinced to believe the whole thing. And I also watched the Joe Rogan, Bob Lazar interview, the whole thing. It was 2 hours. And the more I watch, the less I believe, and I the less I believe him. And that's not a popular view, but it's just a feeling, a gut feeling I have. You know, maybe as an appraiser, really looking into things and watching people and stuff. But anyway, I'm not saying I'm an expert on people, but it just, my thoughts are still that I don't really buy it 100%. However, I do agree that a lot of really interesting things have come about because of what Bob Lazar has said. So I will give him that. And at this point, though, we are about ready to go into break. So my guest tonight is Michael Hall, and we will be right back right after these messages. All right, everyone, that's it for the free part of the show. Thank you so much for listening. Our guests next week, it could be either Bill and Nancy Burns or Dr. Bruce Maccabee. It's going to be one of the two sets of guests there. Just waiting to get it confirmed. So I want to thank everyone that helps out with the show. Anyone can support the show. All that information is over at podcastufo.com. And you can catch the full shows on YouTube. If you can't help us out financially, you can go over there and check them out that way. Anyway, thanks so much for listening, and remember to keep your eyes to the sky.